cliffcentral.com.
Good afternoon. You're tuned into the Daily Maverick Show on cliffcentral.com. My name is Kingsley Kipuri. Finally back after a couple of weeks off. Really great to be back. Greg Nicholson has been holding the fort. Thank you very much, Greg. How are you doing today?
I'm glad you're back. I've got to be honest.
That's all I ever wanted to hear, man. I literally just went away so you guys could appreciate me and the little things I do. Bringing coffee, water, the basics. Yeah, you know, my phone's been acting up, so I haven't been keeping up too much with the news. So I'm just going to assume everything's chilled. No, nothing major's happened in the country in the past 2 weeks. Chilled vibes.
No, of course not. I mean, same old. Nothing to update you on.
Crazy. Today we're going to be talking a bit about taxis. And you know I'm a taxi guy all day, every day. So I've got some stories. I remember being in a taxi once upon a time, and there was like a gentle whiff of smoke that started filling the taxi. I was headed home from work, and somebody shouts "Umlilo." And I was relatively new in the country, so the only thing I knew about the word "Umlilo" was the song. I don't remember who sings it. The song "Umlilo."
So I thought it's a big Nas.
Yeah, the big Nas
like
song. So I thought everybody was just. I thought it was just a vibe, and I didn't make the connection. I thought "Umlilo" meant like fire, as in the vibe, not fire as in you will die. And before you know it, we're all standing outside. The smoke is now, you know, fill the taxi, and the taxi catches fire and almost explodes. So, a lot happened that day. All saying this to explain that today we'll be talking about taxis, right? And I know I say that in jest, but it's been a big, big topic of conversation of the past couple of months. Conversations around how important the taxi industry is to the country. Conversations around safety issues, both within the industry, within different drivers and associations, but also for women, and conversations around the safety or lack of safety of taxis for women. So today we've structured a show to chat to a few people on different sides of this to get a sense of this taxi issue, contextualize the strikes based on an understanding of the taxi industry and how it evolved, giving context to things like associations, things like the owner-driver system, things like how affordable these things are for the drivers themselves, understanding rivalries, tribalism, violence, and really, really making sure that ideally by the end we've got a good sense of the industry and contextualizing some of the challenges that we found over the past couple of weeks. In studio, the first person we'll be interviewing is Mr. Eric Motswane, somebody we've been trying to have on for a couple of years. So, Eric, I'm glad that you're finally here. Eric was former part of the Greater Johannesburg Regional Taxi Council and has a lot of experience in the industry. Eric, welcome to the studio. Wonderful, wonderful, wonderful. So, Eric, just to get started, I really just want to talk about some of the most sort of dramatic parts of your involvement with this. So, what was your role in trying to get the BRT or Rea Vaya system, as we now know it, off the ground? And what was your role in terms of relation to the taxi industry?
And just to jump in quickly as well, for some of our listeners who aren't in Johannesburg, that's the new bus system that came up in Johannesburg. When was it, Eric? About?
In 2009.
Mm. Yeah. So do you want to take us through your role in that process?
Yeah, well, thank you very much. But by the time the city came up with the concept of a BRT system, way back in 2007, 2006, by then I was the chairman of the Regional Taxi Council, taxi body in charge of taxi associations within the city of Johannesburg. And of course, the industry was quite informal by then. And coming up with a concept like BRT system was like a revolution, you know, of public transport within the city of Johannesburg. And of course, given the level of literacy within the taxi industry, given the fact that the industry is used to its comfort zone, you know, when you come up with something new, obviously it will be first be met with resistance, you know, in terms of what is the culture of the taxi industry rather than engagement. And that was by far the most difficult part. You can say, you know, let's sit down and listen to what the city is saying. You know, because by then there were two taxi bodies, even now, two taxi bodies within the city of Johannesburg. That is the Regional Taxi Council and Top 6 Taxi Management. And those two taxi bodies had not seen eye to eye many, many years before then, you know. And given a history of many initiatives by governments that were resisted by the taxi industry, including recapitalization for that matter, a program which didn't work because the industry did not read from the same page and engage government, you know, as a united front, you know. Hence the thing collapsed, and of course it's quite expensive today. It's uneconomical for the industry to run because the industry did not challenge it as a united front, you know. So we looked at initiatives like those, including the initiative by government to try and legalize the taxi industry using what was called the legal campaign, conversion of the permits to operating licenses, you know, which initiative did not accomplish the necessary objectives, you know, because the industry did not read from the same page, you know. So we looked at those and thought, given this radical one, we need to change a bit and say we must work together. The two taxi bodies must work together. And of course, it was a very precarious move to take, you know, to go and shake hands with top six taxi management, you know. But with God on our side, we were able to shake hands and we engaged the city as a united front in terms of the BRT system.
Okay. So for those who don't understand the perhaps some of the structures you're mentioning, but I think perhaps some of the precariousness which you've mentioned may be lost on them. Could you give us a sense of the mistrust and the rivalry between these two taxi bodies that you've mentioned, Top 6 and Regional Taxi Council, and why, and the kind of intensity and perhaps even intimidation that you faced in trying to create this process or facilitate it?
Well, historically, the two taxi bodies had not seen eye to eye for many years by then, simply because the council, which falls under SANTACO, so to say, and Top 6 management fell under a National Taxi Alliance. So there was this tussle of which structure is government recognized, which one is not government recognized, you know. And then, of course, it's natural that those that will claim, in inverted commas, to understand what government is saying would be seen as actually betraying the tax industry, you know, but actually using this challenge of recognition and non-recognition, you know. And that became a challenge because, remember, tax operations by their nature are completely intertwined, you know. So if structures don't see eye to eye and operations and routes are intertwined, to solve a small problem can actually lead to bloodbath, you know. So it was imperative that at that point we narrow the gap and come together as both structures, you know. And of course, I mean, the spin-offs of engaging government in projects like BRT as a united front was that Joburg became quite stable in terms of violence by then, you know, because then both structures were able to sit under the same roof.
I mean, absolutely. I mean, I'm curious about just your, you know, you having to, you know, talk to people across who you are supposed to, you know, be distrustful of, and by nature of this having to work, you need to talk to people at Top 6 and have to come to some agreement. So I'm curious about, you know, some of the intimidation you faced, some of the measures you might have had to go to have these conversations. Do you have any sort of personal anecdotes or memories about some of the, you know, situations you found yourself in when trying to create a way forward?
Yeah, it was quite difficult because, you know, the nature of the industry and the culture in the industry is that you work with mandate, you know. Even if you have good ideas, but if you don't have a mandate to move forward, you know. So my team gave me a mandate to engage Top 6 taxi management, which was quite a risk for me to do because anything could have happened. Because remember, the two taxi bodies had seen violence and people languishing in jail between themselves, you know. And of course, I mean, I historically, I was intimidated. I came under fire from Top 6.
Literally came under fire.
Yeah. You know, I mean, the house I stay in, I built that house 3 times because of the violence, for that matter, you know. But, I mean, being a visionary, a leader, you know, being, you know, having the ability to bounce back, you know, you being resilient, you move forward, you know, and you provide leadership where it's very difficult situation, you know, or circumstances.
I mean, absolutely, and I don't think it's a stretch to call yourself a visionary leader after having to go through some of this. I mean, I think just sticking to one thing, another thing that came up was a tribal element in this. Are there elements of, you know, certain tribes being seen as more legitimate within the taxi industry, others being seen as outsiders? Was that an element that comes up a lot in these relationships?
Well, there's no doubt that the industry has a particular inclination, you know, of a particular tribe, you know, in terms of
Zulu dominant.
Yes, it's quite and of course, in order to be able to gel with it, I mean, you've got to learn that culture.
Yeah.
You know, you've got to learn that culture. You've got to learn that tradition. You know, you've got to come to the level of the people, you know, so that the people see you as one of them, you know, which is something that I did myself. You know, I spent many years in KZN villages, you know, learning the culture, learning the tradition, you know. And that's the reason why I was able to emerge as a leader amongst them, because, I mean, I was able to identify with them. They were able to identify with me.
Okay, thank you. I mean, you're painting a picture of extreme rivalry, potential for violence. It sounds like a very male-dominant, you know, single-tribe-dominant situation. I'd love if you give us some context on this. Could you speak a bit about the how we got to this situation? We have top six and you have, you know, the RTC. And how do we, what do you, could you speak a bit about the origins of the taxi industry, perhaps, you know, pre-94 as an alternative to buses, and how we arrived at this situation? Could you speak a bit about that?
Well, the history of the industry is that, I mean, this is a black-owned initiative.
Yeah.
You know, many routes were crafted by the taxi industry itself.
So just self-regulated norms of operating.
You know, and of course it was for government to enhance, you know. But at the time, the industry was regulated in the beginning, and later it was deregulated, you know, and then it was then a free-for-all, you know. And I think that's where problems came. But with time, then government decided, no, now they're going to formalize the taxi industry, you know. And I think it was at that point where the government was trying to formalize the industry, trying to get reliable databases where the taxi industry now, some associations started merging with others, some started splitting with others, some trying to get the most of the routes as the registration of the routes was underway. And that's where that's where the trouble came. And also take into account that the industry was going through an evolution at that time, from the sedans to the minibuses to the midi buses, you know, and of course then the intervention of mass transit of the buses.
When you talk about the early days of regulation, is that when, I think it's around the 60s, when the taxi industry started sort of springing up? And my understanding is that the apartheid government then favoured the government-sponsored buses.
And the rail system.
Yeah. But the taxis sort of found their own ways to provide transport for people from, I guess, townships and whatnot.
Yes. By far, I mean, there were no permits or operating licenses issued to taxi operators by then, you know, because then there was the rail, and then there were also buses that were running along. And there was a lot of piracy, you know, from the taxi operators by then, you know.
That piracy?
I mean, they were pirating, you know. They were transporting passengers across South Africa everywhere, you know, but like illegally, you know. Illegally, because then no operating licenses were issued by then, you know. But they persisted, you know, until, I mean, at the point where they were given permits, you know, but quite limited, you know. But I think the challenge happens as when the industry was deregulated.
Was that in the 80s?
Yes, that was early 80s.
Why was that? That the all of a sudden the government decided to open the industry up much more?
Well, the only logical conclusion I can come to is that I think the industry was becoming a threat, you know, to the government to the then government, you know, and probably. The deregulation, the idea behind the deregulation was probably to foment violence, you know, so that it causes confusion. And of course, it did go that direction. Unfortunately, we're still enduring the legacy of that deregulation today. You know, obviously, violence has not left us in the taxi industry, you know. But when people talk about violence and analyze violence, there's very little that gets spoken about the role of government in the violence as such. You know, we know that, I mean, there's the level of corruption is quite high, the level of people being conflicted as government officials and owning taxis is rife, you know. The non-alignment of the three spheres of government, where you find national saying this, province saying this, municipality saying this, is a problem, you know. For me, it's a collapse. It's a sheer collapse of leadership on both government and the taxi industry. Because I feel that if you're a leader, you're not just a leader when things are nice, you know. So we know that transport is a backbone of the economy, and it hinges a lot on politics. You know, if there's political willingness to align the industry properly and support it, and kind of like make sure that the industry is well governed, yeah, that there's proper governance, the industry is corporatized to run as business, you know, which is key for me, because leaving the industry in the state in which it is informal, it will not be able to take any challenge in terms of aligning it into a mainstream public transport system, mm, because it's informal. That's why there'll always be resistance, mm, you know. But my view is that if I had it my way, I would put all my money in corporatizing the taxi industry so that it remains as business.
Yeah, I hear you. I think I'm glad that you brought this up, this sort of relationship between taxis and government. I'm curious, just given the history that you've talked us through, thank you, between the 60s, you know, 70s up till now, is part of the problem that perhaps the DNA of the taxi industry is to be at odds with regulation and to be at government, in that, you know, pre-94 governments and apartheid governments, you know, would always saw taxis as a sort of a necessary evil, a grudge, mm, and those regulations were not designed for the industry to flourish. It was about controlling, containing. So it's part of the issue that there's just fundamentally in the DNA of the taxi industry a mistrust of government and a desire to remain informal, a desire to play by their own rules. Is that something that we have to overcome?
Yes, that must be over.
Okay.
It has to overcome that at all costs. At all costs, both by government and the taxi industry itself. You know, I would like to see a taxi industry that take the initiative to self-regulate. You know, I would like to see a government that creates an environment where there's continuous dialogue in terms of sharing ideas, you know, about the future of the taxi industry.
Yeah.
You know, I'd like to see a situation where, for example, we are in BRT, you know, for about 6 years now. We're able to look at the industry from a different perspective. You know, that platform must be created where we're able to share ideas with our colleagues. And say 6 years down the line, out of the industry, this is what we can share with you in terms of being innovative. You know, it is very sad seeing taxis operating 24 hours, you know, without a rest, simply because they cannot afford. You know, it becomes very sad. It's very sad when taxis march to the street because taxis get impounded. You know, for me, I see an industry that has run out of ideas. You know, I see an industry that has reached the apex, you know. But remember, once you reach the apex, you need to go back to the drawing board. The drawing board is not what is there. You know, someone needs to create a drawing board where the industry can go back to and say, but how do we become more innovative,
yeah,
you know, moving forward, you know, because obviously you can bring all sorts of public transport systems, but there must be an integrated public transport system where the customer is, mm-hmm, put at the fore, so that the customer can have a choice whether he goes to rail, bus, or taxi.
Yeah. Okay.
So now that we're running a little bit out of time, I think some of our listeners might be interested in just understanding some of the basics of how the taxi industry works. Perhaps let's use Johannesburg as an example. So if I wanted to own a taxi or own some taxis, a few taxis, can I just buy one? Do I have to join an association? How do I get a route? How does all that work?
I think the first thing is to get an operating license, and then you join a particular taxi association,
mm-hmm,
that will allow you to use that operating license, because then the operating license would depict the routes of a particular taxi association. If they allow you, then you pay the joining fee, then you buy the combi, then you're an operator.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And how straightforward or not straightforward is that, given that, as you've said, routes are power, and I imagine the more taxis you have, the more competition there is. So how welcome am I with my new 5 taxis just walking in and saying, hey, guys, I want to be part of this?
Well, the challenge is, like I said, the self-regulation, mm, and what is there in terms of the law,
mm,
right? Obviously, within the city, there is a certain capacity that a particular municipality can have.
Yeah.
That they can have so many taxis within a municipality.
Yeah.
Right. But if those laws, the rationalization plans, for example, integrated plans, do not work together with what constitute the association. Because remember, the association must also be able to rationalize and say you can have 5 taxis per person. But if the taxi association open floodgates and it goes against the government rationalization plans, then that's how you have the violence. Because then you have more taxis than necessary, but there's no regulation. And like I said in the beginning, the alignment between the 3 spheres of government. Because authorities lie at different levels.
Hmm.
The municipality might not have the authority to regulate the operating licenses. But if provincial government opens up, then it's the municipality that suffers. So there must be able to, there must be an alignment.
And how profitable? So I think I was reading there are something roughly around 600,000 taxis, or a few years ago, that's what it said, on the roads in South Africa. And the industry has a turnover of, I don't know, 30 or 40 billion rand or something very high like that. But is it still profitable to own taxis? Well, last week with these taxi strikes, we saw this issue of how the interest rates taxi owners are charged, and they seem very high. Is it still profitable, or are taxi owners only making sort of marginal returns?
I doubt if the industry is profitable. Hence, I said the industry has reached a point where they've run out of ideas. You know, I don't think it's profitable now. But when you take one step back, you realize that at the point where the government introduced the recapitalization program, that's where the industry would have called the shots and said, this thing is not economical, it's not going to be affordable, this is how we want it. You know, so the government used the failure of the industry to engage them as a unit.
Mm.
Yes, and now today that thing is not affordable, it's an elephant in the room.
So it sounds like you're just describing an oversaturation. Of course, people need to get around, you know, the need for transport is clear, but perhaps when, you know, there's an issue about how many taxis allow this thing to be profitable. So you're speaking about recapitalization. Could you, I know Greg, you did some research on this, but could you speak about the intentions of that and where it fell apart? I know you're speaking about it. Could you give us more details about the intent of recapitalization? And it sounds like an opportunity that was lost.
I mean, the intention were very good intentions,
yeah.
You know, to try and get rid of Skorokoro taxis.
Okay, so the 10-year-old, 15-year-old taxis.
Yes, as far as possible. You know,
put up money for you to get a
yes,
a
and have mostly, by and large, you know, roadworthy vehicles,
yes.
You know. But unfortunately, I think when it comes to the economics,
yeah.
I think that's where the industry did not do a good job, unfortunately. You know, I know at some point, Santaco did come with some schemes, collaboration with banks, which worked much better, but unfortunately those schemes collapsed along the way. But the recapitalization program had all the good intentions, but in reality, it's not affordable.
Yeah, I mean, Greg mentioned also a nice opportunity of, as you provide funding for these safer, newer, you know, vehicles, there's an opportunity to now register everybody and make sure you
exactly.
know who the owner is, who the driver
exactly.
is. There's a beautiful moment there too.
That's what government can get correct in terms of a reliable database so that it knows who's in the tax industry, who's legal, who's not legal.
And how much everybody's making for tax purposes.
Yeah, exactly. Although the requirement to have an operating license in the tax industry is that you must have you must be a taxpayer. So very few people don't know that actually the industry is paying tax. You know, it's a condition. You'll never get an operator unless you're operating illegal.
Yeah.
But any legal operator is a taxpayer in South Africa.
Okay, absolutely.
Yes.
I mean, I think you've been very clear about the misalignment on the government side. I think you spoke about national, provincial, and other local level. And I think what you're saying is that lack of alignment is part of the problem here, and policy alignment. I'm curious about the taxi side. You've already described sort of the mistrust between the large bodies, who's legitimate and who's not legitimate. We've talked about the DNA being, you know, perhaps at odds with government and being informal as just part of how things are done. What do you think we need to see from the taxi side? What are the shortcomings on the taxi side for us to have a frank conversation about affordability and saturation and a way to actually regulate the industry in a way that is profitable and safe for everybody and is a viable living business for the owners and drivers?
Well, I think what is key is to really put all the money in capacitating the tax industry.
Okay.
You know, number one. Number two, there must be enough research into actually who are the players, you know, in the tax industry. You know, historically, government has put lots of money in trainings, you know.
Okay.
But if you look at the basis of training, it does not have any intervention for that matter, because I think there isn't enough research, you know, to look into who actually the players, how did the drivers come into play, who are the owners, you know, do the people that you see in the leadership, are they the people making the decisions, or there are other people that are making decisions, you know. And remember that there's also I remember when we started in PRT, we did a transformation impact study, you know, that will show how many people are going to be affected by the introduction of PRT, so that we mitigate, you know, the outcry that says there'll be, it will cause joblessness, you know, it will be loss of income, you know. I mean, for example, people that wash taxis that don't have any formal agreement with taxis, we also included in, I mean, today they're washing the PRT passes in a formalized sector, because we made sure that we our study is as practical as possible, you know. So it's key that the capacitation takes place, the industry is corporatized to run like business. It cannot be that the violence becomes the order of the day forever. You know, the industry plays a very important role in the economy of South Africa, and it needs to find its rightful place. You know, I can give an example. There'll be a rhetoric that says, no, the industry must be subsidized, blah, blah, blah. The leadership must be able to explain to the taxi industry what is a subsidy, because a subsidy has got its own pros and cons and its own strict regulations. You know, it's not like plucking an orchard, you know, a fruit from an orchard tree in the morning, you know. But the industry must find its rightful place, because it's playing a very important role in the economy of our country.
Fantastic. Eric, thank you so much for making time for us. That was a really helpful breakdown and contextualization. And you know, I'm still working on a special on the creation of Rea Vaya, so I'll try and hunt you down so we can do another private interview.
Sure.
Mr. Eric Motswane, former chairman of the Greater Johannesburg Regional Taxi Council, thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Deeply.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
Okay. If you're tuning in, we're still on the Daily Maverick Show on cliffcentral.com. We're talking about the taxi industry. I mean, there's been a lot of conversations around what's going on. What's the affordability challenge? What's the regulatory challenges, and how do we make sure that they function in a way that's legal, in a way that's safe for everybody, in a way that's safe for women, and it's a way that preserves the livelihood of many, many South Africans around the country. Want to take a short break? We'll be right back. You're back with us on the Daily Maverick Show on Cliff Central. Next, we're going to talk about a more specific aspect of the violence question when regards to taxis, and this is about safety for women. Probably from about March and April coming in, there were a lot of reports around women getting harassed, raped, or even killed as a result of just trying to, you know, do the basics, which is get around, get to work, get home, and move around. So around this, we'll be talking to Ms. Lebohang Ramafoko, who's the CEO of Soul City Institute for Social Justice. Lebohang, can you hear us?
Yes, I can hear you.
Wonderful. Welcome to the show. Lebohang, I mean, you know, the data's out there. I mean, a survey by ActionAid said that, you know, almost 60% of women who travel by taxi say they've experienced violence or harassment. So I think what's clear is that this the reports and the headline-catching news we got, those were not isolated incidents. This is clearly a systemic issue. Now, as part of, you know, your work with Soul City, you've done some engagement with women in communities around this. Could you speak about some of the feedback you got, you know, from everyday women about their realities of just trying to use public transport?
Yeah, as you said, this is unfortunately a daily occurrence for women.
Yeah.
But we really need...
Sorry, Lebohang, can you hear us? Okay, we'll just work behind the scenes sort of to get this, you know, sorted. So Greg, as we, you know, we did the research for this, and as we had the various hashtags, you know, whether you're talking about taxi safety or hashtag men are trash, I think what was driven home was that, yes, the what makes headlines is when, you know, when there's a very massive murder or a kidnapping, but I think what's clear is that these are not, this is something that happens every day. The risk of being harassed in the taxi by the, you know, by a driver or by other commuters. I mean, you and I both use taxis, and then, you know, just the reality of a Bri taxi rank or not taxi rank as just not as being a very hostile and unsafe, you know, unsafe space. And I remember looking at the stats for this. I think it was something about 1 or 2% of the taxi industry is, you know, employs women or is run by women. You told me you've seen a female taxi driver once. I, you know, that has to be, you know, one of two out there. So I think why interesting chatting to Lebo is just the idea of, I think the problem is clear. It's a patriarchal country, it's a patriarchal society that's already hostile for women. You've got an especially hostile and masculine industry in a society that's already hostile to women. So, you know, where do we start? Sorry, Lebo, I'm sorry we lost you. You were speaking about your engagement with women communities and about harassment being a daily occurrence.
Yes, and I'm saying it is informed by the fact that there is general belief that women and their bodies are for the enjoyment of other people. So women themselves don't have a right to their bodies. And the way in which it happens really demonstrates what I am talking about, in a sense that women will talk about, and this is how pervasive it is, just being in a taxi and the mere fact that you are in a taxi, you find the fact that a man can just put their hands on your thigh. And in fact, what I found very disturbing about that is how that has become normalized, in a sense that while it may be done by one man, other people who notice it do not do anything about it. So for an example, you will find that the woman will say, all I do is to smile and not dare say anything, because I don't know if that action can be worse or if the person can just leave me on the side of the road. The danger that we are seeing as well is the fact that when a woman flags a taxi and they get inside it, let's say there are two or three people in the taxi, they are never sure whether that is a syndicate or that it is a valid taxi. There is no way of knowing when you are stopping public transport. And the other problem is the fact that this can happen at any time of the day.
I mean, absolutely. And I'm curious, so how, when you get these issues and you, you know, are trying to have a conversation with the South African National Taxi Council, SANTACO, how is this received from their side?
You know, it's very interesting with SANTACO because they were very willing and to condemn the actions, and their stance is that we would like to cooperate.
Okay.
But I don't see anything that says in their actions they have actually even addressed and interrogated the violent manner in which their members conduct themselves. And you know, when there is a culture of violence, when a group of people condemn on one side a rape of a woman, but in their day-to-day manner in which they conduct their own business, the very first thing that they do is to be violent. It for me, it's a contradiction in terms. And they may argue that, you know, they've got, and I have heard them say that in a panel discussion we had about the pressures that they have, about how government is not treating them fairly. But they don't interrogate. And I think that is the issue with violence against women perpetrated across all boards, is that men do not interrogate their own misogyny and their own ways in which they perpetuate this violence. So, you know, they are saying, we don't want our members to do this. This is a few rotten apples. But then they will have a strike against Toyota, and it can easily end violent, or they can threaten violence. Or they don't explain why there aren't the regulations that are needed to make women safe. And I think for us, what we need to understand is that patriarchy ultimately is about power. And those that have power, even when they are not using violence, even if they as an individual man have not held a woman against their will and stuff, it is very difficult to give up that power. So it's very simple for people to say, of course we condemn, we don't want our members to do this, without really questioning the attitudes and the beliefs that inform, even if it was a few men, and in this case, as I'm telling you, it's not a few men acting that way. For us, we are coming up with a taxi charter because we want all stakeholders, including the Department of Transport, to really look at what it is that it can do to regulate the taxi industry, particularly when it comes to the safety of women and children, a lot better. And the example I always make, because I think for me it is just one thing that shows it's an indictment on our part, is the fact that there are no criminal checks made on anybody who drives a taxi.
Hmm.
So you could be having your child on scholar transport and they are driven by a pedophile. In fact, we've got experiences of that through our Soul Buddies Club program, where it took 14-year-olds to report a 60-year-old man who had been abusing children for a while as he was driving them to school. And if we had checks and balances, as just one example of what needs to be done, and Santiago Department of Transport and everybody else was out there saying we need those criminal checks, it could be better. You don't know when you get into a taxi what you are getting yourself into. The people who are continuing to abduct women are doing so with impunity.
Lebo, just so you've mentioned the charter, you've mentioned certain checks and balances that could be introduced to try to improve this situation, but it appears that not only within the taxi industry, but within South Africa, but obviously let's use the taxi industry as an example, that the culture of patriarchy, the culture of violence against women, and perhaps just disrespecting women, to put it simply, is so entrenched. Where can we even start tackling such an overwhelming challenge?
You know, we need to handle it at all fronts simultaneously. I am very happy to see groups like Soweto Women's Forum that in the past while we have worked with have mobilized other women to speak out about this. And I think you saw even with the recent taxi raid that after one woman had spoken out, more others spoke out. So the idea of speaking out is a very important one. I also like, you know, the voices that were lent by different organizations, because some of these conversations need to happen. I think when pre-94 we were fighting for a non-racist, non-sexist society, we compromised interrogating what it will mean to have a non-sexist society. And whether it is in jokes, whether it is in how men talk about women, whether it's calling a woman a chick as if they are a baby chicken, or whether it permeates in so many ways. And I think once we have the same kind of attitude around race that is beginning to emerge, like it did with the insurance ad, we have it around sexism and other things, you know, you will begin to have people understand what is acceptable and what is not acceptable. And that needs a voice. And that is why for us, as an organization, we basically want to make sure that we put this on the national agenda, and we work with media platforms like you. But the second thing that needs to happen is that men in all their formations, rather than go out there and say we are marching against the rape of women, they must talk about the rapists. You know, it's very simple to say it's our women. I also don't understand what is our women, because it really, for me, underlies that thing of ownership. Men must talk about the rapists. Men must talk about their own actions and how it is a gray area. How one man will think, I am not a rapist, but can completely make sexist jokes without even thinking, can just be misogynistic without even betting an idea. So it is very important, and men like Patrick Chai, who has lent his support to the Sonke Gender Justice platform, is very important. The police need to act. I think we are having a general problem with gender-based violence in South Africa in general, that people talk a lot about how they are treated when they get to police stations. and with the kind of public utterances that the minister Sikile Mbalula said in public, we hope that he is going to clean out in the police, and we will really have specialized units that deal with gender-based violence, and it will be seen to be. It will be given peace.
Absolutely. Lohang, thank you so much for chatting to us. Unfortunately, we've run out of time, but thank you for the important work. We'll continue to watch the Safe Taxis chat and to support your work. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Fantastic. Greg, I think what comes through there is just the size of the challenge. We've already talked about the size of the taxi industry and how perhaps even viewing it as one thing is probably incorrect already, given all the interconnectedness of the different bodies within it. And then secondly, we've got this other beast, which is, patriarchy.
Even I think it's interesting in this conversation how we continually mention Sintaco, the taxi association. Eric mentioned them a little bit before, but the National Taxi Alliance is its rival. That's also a very large National Taxi Association. Yeah. But on issues of gender-based violence and harassment in the industry, I think one of the things Eric seemed to repeat before was that the industry has its own culture, and it's very entrenched, that culture, and you have to learn it, and I think it's going to be very hard to change. And of course, those norms and standards within that culture relate to the broader South African culture. So I think it's fantastic, though, there are certain groups now starting to at least trying to confront some of these issues, because I think, like you said before, both you and I catch taxis, but I don't think we have any experience of that type of sort of fear and harassment and those sort of things that women deal with on a constant sort of daily basis, when you're just going to Brie or MTN Taxi Rank or wherever, and you have to constantly put up with people sort of catcalling you, grabbing your hand, and then swearing at you when you ignore them. But that seems to be, at least from the stories we hear and our friends, what they tell us is that seems to be such a constant in commuters' lives.
Absolutely. I mean, I think one thing, and we're trying to set up one last interview if we can. One thing, when we talked about taxi recapitalization, I know you thought that was really interesting from a regulatory perspective, in terms of a small case study of attempts by government of an opportunity to come in with good intentions to bring some formality, bring some registration to all the taxis, and how something, even despite good intentions and perhaps a good idea, just doesn't work. And that's something you looked into.
Yeah. So we were talking about the future of the taxi industry, and one of the things that sort of kept coming up is actually, so if you look at Gauteng, for example, the province envisages a much smaller taxi industry, or smaller role within the public transport system, in 10 years from now. But what they sort of see happening is linking up, and it's already sort of happening in certain places, is ensuring that taxis and other forms of public transport link up together. So, if you, let's say, having taxi ranks near train stations and or near your BRT, your Rio Vaya stops, for example. But with sort of that integrated role that they hope that the taxi industry can play, what they effectively need to do is to formalize and sort of regulate the taxi industry, which, as we heard before, it's never quite got there. And the government's attempts through things like the recapitalization project to do that have just sort of never quite worked out. And I think it's often because, number one, like Eric mentioned before, there are so many different role players within the taxi industry, and it's hard just to get them to come to any sort of negotiating table, number one, let alone an agreement and a path forward on these issues. Number two, it sort of seems, I'm certainly not an expert on this, and hopefully we can get our next guest on the line to help us out on this, but it also sort of seems that when government introduces some of these plans, they themselves don't quite understand or know how to work with the taxi industry, which is very difficult, and they can push certain things, but in the end, they always seem to fall below their targets, and they effectively always seem to fail, and often even have weird and sort of unintended consequences, such as the economics of what Eric was talking about earlier of, government gives you 50,000 rand to turn in and trade in, I guess, your old crappy, you know, your sort of unsafe taxi.
Yeah, an upgrade, yeah.
And upgrade, but 50,000 Rand is, you know, what's that, like an eighth of the cost? I don't know what it was back then, but an eighth of the cost of a new Toyota Quantum.
Yeah, I think then it was about 200,000 or even more than that was it. And
so then people have to find the money for their, you know, for the next quantum. So I guess they take out loans, but then these loans have very high interest rates attached to them. And so there are all these sort of unintended consequences of that and the efforts of government to use that incentive to effectively try to regulate the industry. Yeah. That's actually what was going on. Yeah. They weren't just one of the ambitions, of course, was to improve road safety and get unsafe taxis off the road. Mm. But behind all that, the idea was to actually try to find much sort of stronger regulations on the industry through formalizing it and ensuring that everyone signed up. We know who's where.
Yeah, we know your owner, we know the driver, we know the car, and you've got a good
sense. That's right. So it's, I think it's going to be interesting going forward considering the government often sort of fails on these issues, how, and the taxi industry is so resistant to change, how as governments try to improve public transport systems, what the future of the taxi industry will be, and we'll see if what Eric said is true, that it may have already reached its apex and will be in decline.
I mean, absolutely. I mean, you were saying something.
No, I was going to say one of the other sort of on the flip side of that's from a government and I guess public transport user perspective on the issues to formalize taxis. But on the other side. Is the issue of if taxis can become more regulated and formalized, then what can happen is that, okay, let me start with this issue of last week you might have seen Sizwe Dlomo and some sort of other guys debating on Twitter about why hasn't the taxi industry been able to leverage its billions and billions of rands worth.
Yeah, there's so many of you have so much money, often in cash, surely you can make something happen.
So why can't they sort of use their economies of scale and start selling their own quantums or whatever, or even manufacturing them or doing all these sort of different things to leverage that power that they have. But the key reason, or one of the key reasons they haven't been able to, is because it's not formalized. It's not a formal structure that they can come together and so divided.
Yeah.
So, for example, I said something before, like there's something towards about 600,000 taxis in South Africa that are in use. The average taxi owner owns 4 taxis. So that means there are about over 200,000 taxi owners in the country.
Yeah.
There's, I think, within Gauteng alone, there's something like 170, 180, that's rough figures, but taxi associations. And then they fit into the bigger associations. It's a very divided and very sort of disparate and sort of fractured and multi-layered industry.
Mm.
So it makes it extremely difficult for them to come together and leverage these economies of scale when they are so separate and when they struggle so much to come together. There was an interesting example, I don't know if you know, but in February in Soweto, a few different taxi associations there came together and started their own garage.
Yeah.
And they're actually undercutting the national petrol price, which supposedly is illegal, but that's what they're trying to do.
Yeah.
But this actually has a precedent. In the 80s, in the mid-80s, I think it was, I can't remember, I think it was one of the biggest black taxi association, I can't remember what the name was then, but they entered into a partnership with Shell Garages. And the idea was that they're going to set up Shell Garages across the country that are sort of run and owned by the taxi industries.
Yeah.
And the taxis would then frequent those garages. Yeah. That was the idea.
Yeah.
But they didn't run them so well, and they didn't offer any sort of, I don't think many of them were started, but they didn't offer enough incentives for the drivers to come there and for the owners to send their taxis to these places. Mm. So in the end, these guys just started using other garages. Yeah. And some of the other garages that had no links at all to the taxi industry actually offered more incentives. Maybe they, you know, that'd help a driver out with a meal or something like that. But so there's this huge challenge of the taxi industry could be this behemoth and mega sort of industry and company.
You've seen as one entity.
And particularly considering that it's black owned, it'd be enormous and sort of game changing in terms of if it was able to leverage the money that sort of passes through the industry. But there are so many challenges and obstacles in reaching that point.
Greg Nicholson, a fantastic summary. I think I've certainly got a better sense of some of the challenges. I think the way forward is not too clear yet, but I think we've done really well at breaking down the complexities, the challenges that come if we're really going to have a sort of well-regulated industry that's safe for passengers, safe for women, that creates a livelihood, sustainable livelihood for the drivers and for the owners, and that's integrated with our attempts to be, you know, at least a world-class city, in quotes, for Johannesburg, and to have efficient transport for the country that gets people, you know, to and from where they need to be in cities and provinces that are really not set up for black people to be able to get from townships to places of work.
If you haven't taken anything else away from this show, I think you just picture this in your head of, you know, everyone running off a taxi, yelling Umlilo and smoke coming in, and Kingsley, not knowing the language, just sitting there, not knowing what's going on, thinking the party's about to start.
I think that's it for today. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for listening to the Daily Maverick Show on cliffcentral.com. Back to have Greg and I both in the studio. As usual, please download the podcast, share it far and wide with your friends and family. We'll see you next week, same time, same place.
Cliffcentral.com.